is A21-16-12, Jesse Lambert Colburn, petitioner, respondent, versus Gergana Gancheva, appellant.
Good morning again, everyone. We are here with the Minnesota Court of Appeals on Thursday, June 30th, and we are about to begin hearing the third case scheduled for oral argument this morning. I am Sarah Wheelock, the presiding judge, and I am serving on a panel today with judges Lucinda Jessen and Peter Reyes. We are holding these hearings this morning via Zoom.gov. And so I will address some matters that occur in our virtual format before we begin. Oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recordings of these arguments are generally available within 24 hours on the Court of Appeals page at the Judicial Branch's website. I will note that our appellate rules prohibit anyone from making an audio or video recording of an oral argument unless they have previously received the court's permission at least 24 hours in advance and agreed to comply with specific conditions established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. Counsel, as you are aware, you will each have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you look at your screens, there should be a square in the upper left-hand corner that shows you the time you have for your argument. Please introduce yourself when you begin, as well as identifying who your client is so that our recording is clear. And please mute yourself, but leave your video on when you are not speaking. Finally, if anyone has any difficulty with the technology at any point, please let me know and we will pause this proceeding and try to help because we want to ensure that we are hearing from everyone. So with that, counsel for appellant, please begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Leah Warner and I represent the appellant, Gergana Gancheva, and I will refer to her as Jerry during my argument today, as that was what she refers herself as to. This case is on appeal from the Clay County District Court in the 7th Judicial District. This is an action for custody and parenting time brought by the respondent, Mr. Jesse Colburn. Following a trial, the referee of the district court awarded sole physical custody of the party's minor child, Evan, who is now age 3, to Mr. Colburn and awarded Jerry parenting time. Jerry has filed an appeal from the referee's findings of fact, conclusions of law, order for judgment and decree. And our position is that the district court erred in its judgment awarding Mr. Colburn sole physical custody for a number of reasons. First, one of the issues that I think is paramount to this case is that the district court erred in its pretrial ruling regarding the limiting the length of trial to 1 day. Also, the trial court applied a presumption that has no basis in Minnesota law when it awarded Mr. Colburn custody of the child, basing its findings primarily on a finding that was made that Ms. Gancheva or Jerry had committed domestic violence against Mr. Colburn. Also, we do argue then in general that the district court erred in finding that the best interest factors favored an award of custody to Mr. Colburn. The issue that I think is an overarching issue in this case is the district court's error in limiting the length of trial to 1 day. Factually, I'll just briefly indicate what happened is that the parties, after the action was served, stipulated to the cancellation of the initial case management conference hearing and decided to proceed with ADR. There was no scheduling conference that was held. The court issued a pretrial order setting a pretrial hearing for June 24th of 2021. The scheduling order is found at docket number 20 and indicated that the matter was set for a full day trial. There's no express limitation on the amount of days for trial and it does not indicate that the number is one for the number of days of trial. There was a temporary motion hearing on May 4th of 2021 and there was no indication at that time that the trial length would be limited in any fashion. So at the pretrial hearing, the court informed the parties indeed that it would be limiting the trial to 1 day. And that was held on June 24th of 2021 approximately 2 weeks prior to the start of trial. At that point...
Excuse me, counsel, wasn't there like a March scheduling order talking about a full day of trial? I thought that, but am I, did I just call that wrong?
No, you're right, Your Honor, that the docket number 20 does indicate that it that the matter is set for full day trial. So it doesn't indicate one full day trial. I mean, it doesn't set any limitation on the fact of full day trial or what that means. And I'll explain a little bit more about the practice in Clay County and in other just districts as well, that there's if a party is going beyond their time or that the court matter is not going to be finished within the amount of time, there's generally no limitation on the amount of days. The court will set an additional amount of time beyond that to finish up the trial. And so there's no indication, there's no hearing, there was no submission by counsel that indicated that we would be done in one day. Although the court did state that at the pretrial hearing that the parties had submitted to the court that one day was sufficient, that never happened. There's nothing in the record that would support that. In fact, when we were talking about it at the pretrial hearing, which is the transcript has been submitted to this court, that she could not find any evidence that we actually had told her one day was sufficient. And if you look at the other filings, particularly the witness and exhibit list for both parties, Mr. Colburn had identified 7 witnesses and Ms. Gentivageri had submitted 9 witnesses. So there are 16 witnesses that are identified in the witness exhibit list. And at the hearing on the pretrial matter, both parties identified to the court that each would be calling a minimum of 4 to 5 witnesses. And so whether or not that included the parties or not, at this point, I cannot tell from the record. But that was a significant amount of witnesses for a limited amount of time. And so an objection was raised at that pretrial hearing that this was not enough time. And you can read the transcript as to what the conversation ensued as regarding whether or not that this was going to be overruled or, you know, she would allow more time. And her decision was no, she would not. And the only reason that she cited was that it would be clumsy and awkward for one day to be set in July and potentially another date to be set down in the future. And she indicated potentially September as a possible time frame. But there was no indication that other than the awkwardness or clumsiness that this would, that there was any other reason to limit the trial. This case involved...
I'm just struggling here because we review this. I think you agree for an abuse of discretion, right?
That's correct. But I also do believe that this matter is, if you look at this matter overall and the case law that is developed around this issue, that this does not exactly just raise an abuse of discretion standard, but whether or not there's a violation of my client's fundamental rights to due process and having a full and fair hearing. And that did not happen here. She was not entitled to a full and fair opportunity to present her case. There is evidence that at the hearing itself, that one of the witnesses that Ms. Gentivageri did have available was going to be available. Her father had passed away that morning and obviously was unavailable to testify. One of the witnesses was waiting in the, waiting room or waiting to be let into the meeting. And she was never to be able to be called. And one of the things I think that is relevant to this case is that the court and Mr. Colburn have pointed out that at times Jerry did not present enough evidence or she presented no evidence. And in fact, one, she did present evidence in several instances. And we have exhibits that we've attached to and referred to in our brief where there was evidence. Also, the party's affidavits had been admitted into evidence as direct testimony, and the court did not apparently consider Ms. Gentiva's affidavit when it made a finding that she presented no evidence of various factors, particularly the domestic violence factor. But in addition to that, there was no opportunity to present the evidence. And so one of the questions that this whole due process issue raises is whether or not a party has that opportunity to present evidence, and then the issue of whether or not what would she have provided? Would it have changed the court's mind? We don't know at this point.
Well, did your client make an offer of proof? You know, this is the evidence that I wanted to, that if I had time, I would call these witnesses. This would be the additional evidence.
Your Honor, the one thing that has come up in my research on this issue is that this is the procedure in which someone is to do this sort of, proffer would require that the court entertain one of the things that, and I would say, yes, I did. In fact, when I said that one of the witnesses regarding Ms. Gentleva's parenting, who had provided an affidavit to the court, that she was unavailable that day. And so the court was aware that there was witnesses available or not available that day who would testify as to Ms. Gentleva's parenting. One of the criticisms in the brief that's filed by the respondent is that she didn't have any testimony of family or friends to verify her parenting. But the reality is she didn't have time. And that is a concern. And so to say that she did not provide the evidence on one hand, but then limit her ability to do so on the other is a significant restriction of her due process rights. This court has found that there are liberty rights involved with, you know, parenting of the children. The United States Supreme Court in Troxell versus Granville, 530 U.S. 57, cited page 65 from the Supreme Court in 2000, has found that their parents have fundamental rights regarding the care, custody, and control of their children. And the matter that's involved in this case is obviously the care, custody, and control of this child.
If I may, Ms. Warner, just going back to your, you know, the district court on, I think I'm summarizing this correctly, on one hand said you didn't provide evidence on this and then that limited your client's ability to do that. Okay, so my question is, because I thought that the district court was holding both parties to the same time limits. I mean, so my question to you is that true or not? Because I mean, I think that your criticism goes further if your client didn't get as much time as respondent's client.
No, the court did keep time, and there was actually a dispute about the time, which actually took up some of the time that was available. And so there was a clock being kept, but this preoccupation with the clock is really the problem. So whether the court, this isn't a matter necessarily of just procedural fairness, but it's a matter of substantive fairness. And so procedurally, the court kept a clock. And what ended up at the end was my client testifying, essentially what I would call like a game show type atmosphere where she's trying to beat the clock and get in as much information as she could. Where there were objections as to how she was answering questions on two occasions because of this need to get things and matters before the court. And clients and litigants should not be compromised in that fashion. That is not a full and fair hearing. It does not present an ability for her to present her case in a fair fashion. And that is a violation of fundamental rights that are afforded to people under the Constitution. I mean, these are parental rights. These are issues regarding the best interests of children, and parties should not be compromised, and neither should the court, frankly, on receiving all of the information that's necessary concerning the best interests of this child. And that's what happened here, is that you can see where I have had to cut my own client off during testimony from the transcript. And there was not an opportunity to present all the evidence, including additional witnesses. And frankly, the full testimony of my client, she had to alter the way she was, you know, testifying because she didn't have enough time. And that is not a situation that the courts have allowed, have indicated that is appropriate for litigants. And it does not actually look at, first of all, one is her rights to be violated as to a full hearing. And also the public's interest in making sure that there's confidence in the judicial system. So when you get an order that you know that has been compromised by the limitation of time and not the ability to present all evidence, what confidence can people have in the judicial process? And that is a significant issue for not only this court, but every court, in that there should be an opportunity to have a fair hearing on the matter. Also, I would like to say one thing about the amount of time. It is true that the parties had equal time. But there was a temporary order in this case, and the court actually says at one point in time that Evan has adjusted well during the temporary custody for time, and that was a matter of 2 months only. So looking at those 2 months, the court basically made some findings that this child's adjusted and he's doing well. Well, that is basically a product of then this temporary order being the status quo, which is contrary to what the law states regarding what effect temporary order should have on this case. But because of that, my client really had an additional burden to overcome. And was it fair for her to have just the same amount of time as Mr. Colburn, who already had the upper hand with the custody order? No, we would argue not. I do want to move beyond this because I have raised...
Yes, Ms. Warner, actually, you only have less than 2 minutes left and we haven't even gotten to the best interest factors at all. But I do want to start with a question on the law on our standard of review. You argue that the district court erred in one, interpreting best interest factors, and two, and in applying the best interest factors. But we apply an abuse of discretion standard for the application or the evaluation of the best interest factors.
Thank you, Your Honor. And that actually goes to this issue of the Thornton versus Vasquez case that's cited in my brief. That's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2019, where the court did find that the application of a presumption against the victim or to the victim for an award of custody was a question of law for the court. And so the court did analyze that under a question of law standard. And so that is a different standard than what the application of each particular factor and the facts underneath is. But we're arguing that there's a presumption that was made. And if you look at the temporary order hearing transcript, the court said one factor basically favored Mr. Colburn, and the factors, and that was because there was a finding of domestic violence. So obviously, we dispute that finding, but that is obviously a question of fact. But that created a presumption that Mr. Colburn was awarded custody of this child because my client had allegedly committed domestic violence in this case for no other reason. There's no other reason cited in that temporary order hearing transcript for him to be awarded temporary custody. Our argument is that set up the status quo. And so if you look, the court has, there's 12 factors, none of them to be addressed to the exclusion of the others. And in this case, that is what happened. Our position is that.
I just want to be clear here and ask you to answer this. But you were talking about not a basis for something in the temporary order, but here you're appealing the final order, right?
That's correct. But our position, just to, I'm not aware of time, is position is that one, the temporary order created a status quo, and the final order does also follow this same presumption, because I can argue when touched on my last few minutes that several of the factors in the findings flowed from the finding of domestic violence, not from anything else, but just from that domestic violence finding.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And we will turn to counsel for respondent. The clock is reset, and you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning, justices, counsel. My name is Travis Jung, and I represent the appellee, Jesse Colburn. And I'm asking this court to affirm the district court's decision to award sole custody to Jesse, and to basically affirm the lower court's order in all respects. This appeal really, above all, is sort of an attempt at a second bite at the apple, so to speak, maybe even a third. Jerry would like this court to rehear facts that are favorable to her case, and she's sort of cherry-picked those for you and given them to you through her brief. And really the reason that she's done that is because she didn't convince the district court the first time around. So as we know, it's not your job to reweigh the evidence, to be the fact finder, to assess witness credibility. And as this court said in the Sefcow case, these are really the province of the district court, and appellate courts typically defer these duties. I sort of had an order that I would have wanted to go in today, but we spent so much time talking about the time limitation that I think I'd like to start there. In Jerry's own brief, she cited to the Eighth Circuit case, U.S. versus Bednar, that said pretty clearly that trial management decisions are firmly within the discretion of the district court. And as they pointed out, and I believe one of you also pointed out, that an abuse of discretion only happens if a party is unable to fully and fairly present their case. And our own rules of evidence will allow trial courts to place reasonable limits on the presentation of evidence for a few reasons: to avoid undue delay, waste of time, or presenting needlessly presenting cumulative evidence. And in fact, I believe Minnesota Rule of Evidence 611 says that trial courts must exercise strict control over the length of trials. And Justice Jessen, I'm glad that you brought up several points that I'm going to bring up as well. And that is that both parties were fully and fairly able to present their case. And as you mentioned, and you probably pulled it from my brief, we got a scheduling order on March 1st that clearly said in bold lettering, mind you, that the trial is set for a full day hearing commencing July 9th. That gave us a 4-month warning. And it was very clear to me that we were going to have one day to present this case. And when the time came, Jesse and Jerry had the exact same amount of time to present their case. We were keeping track to the minute. We each had our own timers. The court had its own timer. And there was nothing unfair or one-sided about it. Another thing is this really isn't a complicated case. It's a custody and paternity case. We agreed beforehand at one of our pretrial hearings that we were going to set aside all child support matters, everything financially related, taxes and insurance and all that stuff. We were going to set that stuff aside for the expedited child support process instead. Another thing that's pretty relevant too is that we stipulated on the record that all affidavits that were being submitted into evidence, so long as that affiant was made available for cross-examination, were going to be included into evidence. And both parties, through this temporary order, really had presented their case already in full through their respective motions.
Mr. Young, if I may, so was that stipulation as to the admissibility of the affidavits, was that made after? I just want to understand, was that made after the objection to the trial being limited to one day? I'm just trying to understand.
I mean, right.
So Ms. Warner say, look, I only stipulated to this because I was told we only have one day.
Right. And I think we talked about it we had two pretrial hearings, and I think we talked about it at least one of those. And again, prior to like the morning of our hearing, I think Ms. Warner and I had discussed it informally on the phone that we were going to agree to those affidavits coming in. But on the record, the day of the hearing, we also stipulated that all affiants, so long as they're made available, their affidavits will come in. And it wasn't even necessarily that they're made available, but they needed to be sworn in. So we had all of our affiants ready and here, and even... So I think that we had 4 or 5 of our affidavits come in, but Jerry was the only person besides one other person that gave any testimony at all. So her affidavits were left out. Of course, if she wanted to have some of her affiants available, it was my understanding that no other affiants were even available to testify, even if they wanted to. And I guess that falls on them, and that wasn't a time restriction thing. But either way, in Jerry's temporary motion for temporary relief, they submitted 200 pages of evidence, including 12 different affidavits, her own 50-page written affidavit, exhibits, you name it. The district court had seen all this stuff already. And, you know, I understand that interim affidavits can't come in as evidence, but we agreed if she would have made those affiants available, sworn them in, and taken any direct testimony or allowed me to cross-examine them, then they could have been included as well. I think we had one affiant on our side that wasn't sworn in. So the court had really an overabundance of information already. And like we said, again, we had another pretrial hearing on June 24th, more than 2 weeks before the hearing, where the court really made it abundantly clear that we were only going to have one day for our hearing. And to be honest, 2 weeks is enough time for Jerry to cut the fat from her argument. And we certainly did. I mean, we could have called more witnesses. We could have spent a lot more time cross-examining Jerry. We could have spent a day or more talking about the bond that Jesse has with Evan. But we knew that we were only going to have one day. So we used our time as best as we could. And I don't feel that anybody was left with the short end of the stick. Referee Solheim received plenty of information as far as that goes. So, and again, the bottom line is that abuse of discretion standard, as far as this is concerned, the court didn't abuse their discretion in decisively managing the scope of the trial. And those decisions are pretty firmly within the court's inherent authority.
You mentioned the abuse of discretion standard. I want to turn to the best interest factors, because we review the district court's determination with respect and evaluation of the best interest factors for an abuse of discretion. A district court can abuse its discretion either by making findings that are unsupported by the evidence or by improperly applying the law. The district court references the domestic abuse incident. And why did the district court improperly apply the law by having that taint to the rest of the analysis of the best interest factors and having that presumption there?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I had sort of rolled this one around in my head a little bit too. I don't believe that the lower court misinterpreted the statute. I think that Jerry has misinterpreted that statute. So her entire premise of that argument is sort of flawed. She's claiming that the court arbitrarily implemented a presumption that a victim of domestic violence should be awarded sole physical custody, but the court's analysis, including all the other 11 best interest factors, were more complex than that. So the best interest analysis as a whole, and I believe, despite the domestic violence factor, demands that physical custody land with Jesse. And they're relying on the Thornton case, which says that the court doesn't, or the presumption doesn't operate for or against one particular party, nor does it impose a burden of producing evidence to rebut the presumption. The presumption is only against joint physical or joint legal custody. And the evidence as a whole, including all the rest of the best interest factors, point to Jesse having sole physical custody. I don't know that the court ever considered having the parties share physical custody. And again, in Thornton, that presumption is not on preferring a custodian, but a preference against a certain custodial arrangement. And that's the joint physical custody arrangement. And the presumption focuses on the child's needs and not on either of the particular caregivers, which I do want to talk about the best interest of the child factors a little bit. I don't want to get too far into them because I think our briefs do a pretty good job of pointing out our stance on each of those. But again, our courts have said that the district court has great leeway in making custody decisions that serve a child's best interests. And this court made pretty thoughtful and thorough findings on each of the best interest factors. The evidence supported the findings and the court was justified in making the decision that it did. Jerry believes that the court got 10 out of 12 factors wrong. 10 out of 12. I've said this before, and I'll say it again today. This says a lot more about Jerry's self-generosity than it does about the court's work in this case. With the exception of factor C, which talks about the preference of a mature child, that clearly isn't relevant because Evan wasn't even three at the time of trial, and factor E, the mental and physical health of the parties, she believes that the court got all the other factors wrong, five of which favored Jesse, seven of which were found to be neutral or not applicable, and zero factors favoring Jesse. That aside, the burden that she has is still pretty sky high. And as you said, Justice Reyes, the court has said that when the issue turns on the district court's findings of fact, the Supreme Court is reviewing for clear error. And appellate courts give a ton of deference to the district court's opportunity to evaluate witness credibility and reverse with that special language if they're left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made. And I want to talk about credibility with my last minute 40. The district court is in the best position to evaluate witness credibility. Anyone that's read the district court's findings in this case, both in its order for temporary relief and in the final judgment, is going to tell you that Jerry's biggest pitfall was her unbelievability. They're using words like untruthful, unreliable, not credible, dishonest, and talking about both her written testimony and her sworn testimony. So Jerry's argued that the district court ignored facts that were favorable to her, but the truth is the district court probably had a hard time believing the words that were coming out of her mouth. So it wasn't that she wasn't given the opportunity to present evidence. It was that she did, but the district court really took a lot that she said with a very big grain of salt. She had unsubstantiated claims of abuse at the hands of Jesse, and she had a disregard for her own abusive behavior. Her words can't be trusted, and clearly that was something that referee Solheim picked up on as well. So just a final thought, the district court did its job and did it well. It considered the evidence on the record and issued thoughtful and sufficient findings. The evidence and the record support its decision. It's not your job to reweigh evidence or assess witness credibility. That is the district court's job. So its work should be affirmed in all respects. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, counsel. And we will turn to counsel for appellant for the last word. You will have 5 minutes, and you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to dovetail on what Justice Reyes Jr. has just indicated. First of all, those factors or the finding of domestic violence did taint the other factors. If you look at the order, the A, D, G, J, and L. So five factors hinged on a finding of domestic violence. And so 5 out of the 12 were based solely on a finding of domestic violence. The other factors were basically neutral as to the parties. And there, obviously, there is an abusive discretion standard, but I do want to talk about that to a certain extent, because when we talk about this fact that the court basically made this temporary decision, and an argument that was just made by counsel said, this court had 200 pages of evidence to consider at the temporary hearing. And that they had plenty of information to decide this case. However, we just noted that the affidavits from my client's perspective, other than her own, were not admitted because she didn't have enough time to call the people who were to be cross-examined if the affidavits were admitted. So they were not part of the trial record. Also, the law is clear that a temporary order has no bearing on the permanent order. So whatever she had read prior to the trial, those 200 pages, shouldn't have been part of her analysis, unless, of course, they were admitted in evidence that day. And they were not. because there wasn't enough time. And so arguing on one hand that, oh, the court had all this information to consider, and actually she says at the trial, well, I have all this information to consider, but she didn't allow that information to come in because my client didn't have enough time to call those people. Also, I would like to note that there are factors that concerning credibility, concerning the domestic violence finding, where the court's decision is, frankly, an abuse of discretion. During the domestic violence discussion and her findings, she indicated that some of the facts that Mr. Colburn had testified to were irreconcilable based on the need to, or based on testimony that was provided by him in his affidavit and also from police officers in the police reports. They were all inconsistent in some way or another.
But counsel, the district court did acknowledge that. The district court did acknowledge that there were some minor inconsistencies, but really relied heavily on credibility determinations. And on appeal, we defer to the district court in terms of its credibility determinations. We don't second guess that.
Right, but I can understand that, Your Honor. Also, but keep it in mind, if the evidence does not support those determinations, such as irreconcilable testimony and affidavits and police reports, those do not support findings.
But the also, district court did support the findings that it had with aspects of the record, while acknowledging some minor inconsistencies, did note that there were, the district court found the police officer's testimony, the district court found respondent's testimony more credible and consistent with, more consistent. That's a purview of the district court to do, right?
It is, Your Honor. And I understand that the credibility issue is not my client's like best argument here. We understand that. However, it goes to a couple different things. One is because there was a need to cross-examine officers, that took up additional time for my client and unable to present additional witnesses on her behalf. We did find that, explored the fact, and there was a finding that there were inconsistencies that were irreconcilable. Also, this is one of 12 factors, and why does it taint the rest of the factors? By all accounts, my client is an excellent mother. She is the parent who basically provided the majority of the care for the child. Mr. Colburn worked during the day. She stayed home. She arranged. This is all by his admission now from the trial transcript. She was the one who did the research to care for Evan's special needs, was the one to take him to all of his appointments, to set up the care. He's a part of the guard. He said, admittedly, my time with the child with the caring was on the weekends. Well, he's gone one of those weekends every month. So the rest of the time is with my client. He also has additional guard duties. The fact that like my client is the one who has furthered his social and educational, again, his criticism was that she does too much with him. She's the one who, basically provided for finding the child care, did all of the things that are right in this case. Those were completely overlooked by this court to the detriment of one factor. And that presumption, as it indicated, is against a custodial arrangement, not a person. And our argument is that it was held against her as a person to not be awarded custody of this child or even joint custody of this child because of that. We're asking, Your Honor, that we have opportunity for a new trial in this matter, or additional time for trial, because it was limited to my client's constitutional detriment. And also that the court remand with findings that the court consider other factors in addition to the domestic violence factor, that there is no presumption that Mr. Colburn should have been awarded custody simply because he was the alleged victim.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys here today for your helpful arguments and briefing. The court will take this matter under advisement.